Okay. My name is Stacy Sobel. I'm 40 years old. Today is December 26th, 2018, the day after Christmas. And I'm speaking with my mom, Linda Sobel. We are recording this interview in Coral Springs, Florida. Okay, so Mom, you wanted to talk about...
The attack on our science a long time ago, but you were around and... Yes, you were around.
So, what do you want to... Tell me what you want to... Well, first of all, why do you want to talk about this?
Oh, I think that it's a most unusual thing, and it could have affected us quite negatively. And I think it also has some characteristics of me in particular about saving everything that saved our lives, because if I had not saved all of our data and that for a longer period of time than a scientist does, then we would not be in this house, maybe not in the U.S., who knows what would have happened, but we wouldn't have been able to defend ourselves. So it would have been quite a different life, I think.
Did you want to, looks like R2, do you need a lap, R2? He wants to come
up
here.
The dogs are here.
We've got Red and R2 here.
I guess we can take a picture in the end.
Yeah, they could be in the picture too. Okay. Do you want to start off with talking about what the controversy is, or what happened?
Okay, so before you guys were born, Dad and I did some research that actually went against all the grain of science. Nobody had done this kind of work. And
what kind of work?
It was on moderation, also known as controlled drinking. That is to say, the people with alcohol problems could return to moderate drinking without having any consequences.
And what kind of study was it, or studies?
Oh, it was a randomized controlled trial that was funded by one of the institutes, NIH, in the government. And it was done out at Patton State Hospital in San Bernardino. Mm-hmm. But I can just give you some quick things leading up to it. So how we get out there is a backwards wired dial board. And so Dad and I were walking the halls of the...
Is this how you got to San Bernardino?
I'll explain it. So Dad and I were walking along the hallways in the Department of Psychology at the University of California, Riverside, where he was a graduate student finishing up, and I was a junior undergrad. And we had already moved in with each other, and so we went out there. Oh, I know what happened. So Dad was walking along with this diode board, and in those days, a diode board are these leads that were in like radios and other things that made things move and so forth. And there were like maybe 200 diodes, so that's 400 solder points. And this guy who worked out there was also a colleague of Mark's, Roger. Said, do you program operant conditioning equipment to Mark? And Mark said yes. And he said, well, there's a job out there. We need somebody programming and fixing operant conditioning equipment. This is like for running rats and pigeons. And Mark's scholarship was running out for the summer. So he said, he'd love to interview for it. So he did. And I'm this little junior going, I need a job too. I need a job too. And so they had a job for a research assistant out on the token economy, which is a unit to really kind of promote the skills of schizophrenics and so forth, very avant-garde. You could viewing room and tokens. It was also
called
a token economy. Uh-huh. Well, it was in the state hospital. We were trying to get these people to live better lives, and you would reward them for... putting their clothes away, or for buttoning their clothes, or eating, and things like that, rather than punishment. And I did my first study out there on priming, but that's not important. So I started to work on that unit. Dad was working on another unit on operant conditioning. And then along came a grant for this other investigator, but he decided to leave, and it was on aversive conditioning. And the research director asked Mark if he would be interested in running it. And so Dad said yes, so he moved from the operant conditioning to kind of a research scientist one position. And it was basically, in those days, you put a little mild electric shock on somebody if they were going to drink, and they wouldn't drink, supposedly. Anyway, all of that's not important, but that was in the real early days, that's 1970s, actually the year 1970. And then what happened is the equipment broke down, and...
The diode?
The Darwin Ward, yes. So what happened, I have to really go back for a minute. That's very important. Because we owe our career to a backwards wired dial board, as I said. So we, after Roger said to Mark, did you need a job? And then Mark said yes. He gave him the information to apply. We went down to Mark's lab, plugged in the dial board. Oh no, it didn't work. And so then we looked, and all the leads were soldered backwards, every single one of those 200 leads, which meant you had to cut them off. That's 400 cuts. And resolder it, and there was just basically enough wire to do it.
Oh, God.
Okay, so...
that was Dad's first job?
No, that was on his dissertation.
Oh.
So we got the dissertation done eventually by running pigeons, and then we went out to the state hospital. So now Dad is working out on the alcohol unit, and they're doing this aversive conditioning grant, but the equipment breaks down. Because we were also going to give people feedback about their drunken behavior, show them what they look like. So all the equipment breaks down. We have to send it back to the Midwest someplace. It's going to take 3 months. I mean, things are very slow in those days, very slow mail. And anyway, so in the meantime, we're getting this money paid for the staff and the research assistants, Mark's job, mine, the secretary. We have to figure out something to do. And somewhere in that time period, early on, a man came up to Mark and said, sir, can you tell me why, and this is his words, alcoholics can't drink? And we knew nothing really about the alcohol field. I mean, zero, nothing, maybe even minus nothing. And Mark thought it was a good question, and he said, well, I'll find out to the gentleman. And we went and did a literature review and found that, well, nobody had ever done what we call a randomized clinical trial, randomly putting people in one group and the other, so you don't have bias. And then running them and following them up. But there was other evidence out there that suggested that some people can return to moderation. And the word in those days was controlled drinking, but it gives me every time I say controlled drinking, I go like this.
Why? Mom just did a sort of like an aversive reaction
with her
hands.
Yes, aversive reaction.
Like she got a shock.
Yes, that's true.
wait, so why does it...
Well, you say controlled drinking and you remember how bad the attack was on you.
So that was the words that you used to describe it instead of moderation at that
time?
Yeah,
now everyone talks about low-risk drinking or moderation.
Okay.
And it's really a misnomer because the word controlled means at any point you can go out of control. So low risk describes it, low risk, maybe one or two drinks, or moderation, but low risk is a better term.
The backward diode, how did that lead? I didn't understand. How did that lead? Because it made him take longer on his dissertation, or
no,
what was the...
No, so the backwards wired diode board, if we weren't carrying it, Roger wouldn't have seen that Mark knew how to program upper conditioning equipment.
Oh, okay. You were carrying it because you need to fix it
or
something.
But we were taking it. We had just finished soldering the diodes on.
Ah.
And we were going down to the lab, and it looked impressive. It really was impressive. So Roger saw it, and Roger said to Mark, do you wire upper conditioning equipment?
Yeah.
Mark said yes. So he gave him the information. He did get that job out at the state hospital. But the problem was when we got down to the lab, we learned that every one of the leads was wired backwards.
Oh, no.
Yes, actually, then Mark hired a research assistant out at the state hospital to help him, and unfortunately, Tim did the same thing.
Wait, again?
Yes, again.
Oh, gosh.
So the third time it worked out, but anyway, so we were in Riverside. We moved out to San Bernardino where Patton was. Because Mark was
Patton State Hospital.
Yeah, Mark was basically finishing his dissertation, and I had one more year to go. So we lived at the foot of the mountains, about a 5-minute ride from...
What was your dissertation on and what was Dad's on?
Oh, Dad was on some experimental paradigm with pigeons.
Okay.
Don't have any idea, and I bet you he can't think of it either. And mine was on the validity of self-reports of people with alcohol problems. Basically, do they lie when they're talking to you? Do they say they only had 2 arrests when they had 4?
And was that...
They tell the truth.
So you go for your PhD after you already started doing the alcohol, then you must have.
Oh, yes, for sure.
So that was
for
great.
Sure.
Yeah.
No, I graduated and then went back for in 2 years in 1972 and finished up in 1977. I think that was the date.
Okay, so you're at Patton State Hospital.
Okay, so Dad's now moved on to the aversive conditioning unit because this other guy got the grant, but he left it there, and the director of research wanted Mark to run the lab. So he's running the lab. The equipment breaks down and get sent off to the Midwest. And the gentleman who had an alcohol problem on the unit, inpatient unit, asked Mark if, because we were in the research park, can somebody drink moderately? And Dad said, well, that's a good question. So he said, let me think, look it up. So he sent all of the research assistants out to the literature in those days and to go to libraries and see if anybody had anything that they had written on whether moderation was possible if you had an alcohol problem. And it was actually possible. There were a lot of anecdotal reports. There were some non-controlled trials. And lo and behold...
Try to cover your mouth just in case the volume doesn't get through.
Lo and behold, one of the people that had done some of this research was only about 25 miles away in Irvine, named Dr. Mansell Patterson.
Who became one of your friends, right?
Well, he actually was on my dissertation.
Ah.
And he hired Mark and I at the... Santa Ana Mental Health Center. That's okay. Where we went after Patton. Really amazing guy, brilliant, and that was unfortunately, he's a medical doctor, psychiatrist, was killed by a drunk driver.
Oh, gosh.
I know, what an awful situation.
Was that back then or later on?
In the 80s.
Yeah.
But quite young, still 40.
Mm.
Brilliant mind. We've dedicated one of our books to him after that. And so we're doing some work in the bar lab. We had a bar where people could come. It's called simulated drinking.
Yeah.
Come and drink, and we could teach them how to drink appropriately. We videotaped their drunken behavior. We one day where they could just drink 16 ounces or something over a time period. And actually watching videotape of your drunken behavior is quite stressful. Imagine you're really, really badly drunk.
Oh.
You have to see it the next day. No. I would never go vino tinto again, probably. Anyway, it's probably quite stressful. So in the meantime, Mark up thinking about the whole idea about whether people with an alcohol problem could drink moderately or not. I'm yawning, sorry. And... he designed a very scientific study called a randomized clinical trial, so that we had two arms, or they called them arms, one where people who should be abstinent and one who people who could drink, let's say, moderately or non-abstinent. And then if you put 40 people in the group, you randomly assign them. This is done like through a table of random numbers. So this person would go into the control group, and the control group was the routine state hospital treatment, just come in, talk in groups, go out, nothing really therapy-wise.
And these were people with how severe of their alcohol problems?
Oh, extremely chronic.
Okay.
As chronic as you can get. They were in the state hospital. In those days, you could be in for 6 months, but they were in for a long time. And so anyway, so it was just standardized treatment. They would sit in groups, and then they would have AA meetings and so forth. What we did is we actually gave them a therapy intervention, a behavioral intervention, plus the videotape feedback and moderation and everything else. And so basically if we just concentrate, abstinence is not an exciting topic then, because people, that's the goal. But if we just look at the two groups, that moderation, the experimental treatment that we had, or moderation, the AA state hospital treatment. And the state hospital treatment was known not to work at all. Very effectively. There's really nothing out there doing therapy. They're just kind of sitting in a group talking, and they come in, it's a revolving door, they get detoxed. So we ran the study, and we finished it up in 2 years, and we did a follow-up. We followed them up every month, going out to see where they were, calling. We had letters. There was nothing fancy like email and faxes in those days. Then we did 2 years follow-up, and actually even doing 3 months follow-up was unusual in those days. We were very intense, kept very detailed notes.
Mm-hmm.
Anytime I went out to a patient's house, I would not mark down the chart that I went out, and the time we have to have logs for mileage reimbursement, everything. It was just any card we got from them, any mail we got from them, we kept notes of all of our phone calls and collected very detailed intensive data, which a lot of researchers hadn't done at that time. Mm-hmm. It was the most detailed study they'd ever seen. Mm-hmm. So it got some publicity. Newsweek and Time Magazine mm-hmm. heard about it. They came and filmed the bar lab. I mean, we have a bar, a real bar, in the state hospital.
Yeah.
In that. So they filmed some stuff and so forth. And we knew that it was kind of, it was kind of a hot topic, but didn't realize how hot until a little bit later. So, go Red. So, the grant was for 2 years, and we knew it that 1972, I was getting ready to graduate, and Mansell Patterson offered Dad a job as a senior research a person, scientist, down in Orange County at the alcohol and mental health place, and he offered me a full-time job as running a unit there, and I started going back to school then in September 1973, I think. I might have a year off here and there. And so I worked full-time and went to school full-time, and then all of a sudden we started to get some interest in our work. We're still in California. And people were inquiring, especially the media, can it really be done? Nobody believed it could be done. And so it went all over the place. And then a lot of traditionalist people, not recovered people and AA and others, because nothing had ever really been done, said that it couldn't be done. And then there were rumors that maybe we made our data up, things like that. I mean, it was really like a religious warfare. And there was no stopping them. It would be like saying there's no God or there's no Jesus Christ. So people really were angry and that.
Well, they're angry because your model challenged the conventional model?
Yes,
and the conventional thinking.
Yes, and actually, exactly.
Was there anyone that was, I mean, some people maybe were excited. Was there anyone excited?
Well,
or?
There weren't, psychologists weren't really working in the alcohol field in those days. It was kind of the scourge.
Okay.
People would say, why are you working in it? People were working in like depression and anxiety, things like that, that seemed to be more interesting to them. But alcohol and drugs were hardly existent at that time. But alcohol was like, oh my God, why would you want to go work with a quote alcoholic, which is not a word that Dad and I use. And I don't know, we just kind of liked it. We were headed in other directions. Dad was going to be a pigeon, apron conditioning, behavioral man. I was working in verbal learning. I actually wanted to go to medical school, but then I mentored Dad and thought psychology would be great. The rest is history. Anyway, so I go on to graduate school. We both get jobs again at Orange County Mental Health Association, running the alcohol inpatient outpatient unit, offering outpatient treatment short term. Short term was 90 days in those days. Now it's down to 3 or 4 sessions, but it was better, shorter than the inpatient 6 months. So we published our stuff. Now in the scientific,
in like journals,
in journals, stuff, professional journals, peer reviewed journals. We published the 6 month data, the first stuff. We published 1 year, 2 years. It's getting a lot of attention. Dad and I are getting invites. We're young. We started the work when we were 20 and 24.
Wow.
So when we left, we were 22 and 26. And then we went down to Orange County, and still again, Mark. And
so when it started to get famous, what were you in your 20s?
Yeah, Mark was 26, and I was 24.
22.
Yeah, 22, sorry.
So do you think that was part of the reason why there was also a reaction, like kind of a bit ageist, like, oh, you're too young and you don't...
Well, I think the age probably was a topic of conversation. We always called the young people, which I wish we were called now, but those young people... they were so young. We had no experience in the alcohol field. Probably no experience in the alcohol field was worse for some of the traditionalists, as we call them, than our ages. But there was some, like, one of the very famous people, Ivar Lovaas at UCLA, said to somebody that we knew, how the heck could you hire a graduate student to run that very important research? So he wasn't happy that Dad was a graduate student. Well, what happens is we were so naive that all we wanted to do, and that's all we ever wanted to do, was just good science. You'll hear Dad say that, I say that. And so we designed a randomized clinical trial, which is at the heart of all good science. We didn't have all those preconditions in our head and anything like that. There was nothing really out there, no how to do follow-up, no how to measure drinking. One offshoot of the research is we have the premier drinking measure in the world called the Timeline Followback, and it's now endorsed by the entire field. It's called the gold standard. It's endorsed by the FDA, how to measure for drug trials and things like that for alcohol and even drugs now. So we have several offshoots of the research that were really exciting. So let's just fast forward.
And did the Timeline Followback get developed as part of that early work in the 70s?
Yes, it was then called the Daily Drinking Disposition. But It was like how you measured drinking in those days was called very crude, improved, same or worse. Well, with no definitions, you could have somebody drinking 40 ounces a day and then go down to 25. That's improved.
So wait, well, improved, same or worse is?
Okay, from their baseline.
Okay, got it.
Okay, sorry.
But it wasn't numbers.
No, there were no numbers. That's why it was very subjective. I mean, clearly, going from 40 ounces to 25 ounces is improved, but it's still associated consequences, risks to livers, kidneys, things like DUI.
Yeah.
But we needed real specific numbers, particularly because of the moderation thing. Did they go from 10 to 3? Because there are what we call low-risk drinking cutoffs. So for women, for example, it's on average no more than 7 drinks per week, mm-hmm. or no more than 2 per day. But that's not to say you can have 3 on a holiday day. For men, it's no more than 14 per week.
Mm-hmm.
And there's reasons why men and women have.
And men are double. That's a lot more.
Yeah, because it has to do with the amount of water that's in the body and the body size and things like that. That's why you'll get a higher blood alcohol level than a man and woman will.
Mm-hmm.
And it's okay. And so where are we? So things start to, we are doing our work in Orange County. I'm mm-hmm. getting my degree, doctorate, and then we kind of hear things here and there that people don't believe it. But by that time, we didn't really think anything was ever going to happen because we had a confidential list. We weren't breaking confidentiality. It's very much like today. Oh, okay, I'm going to move the little doggy over here.
Well, you didn't think anything, meaning any what was going to happen?
Well, anybody could really go after the subjects because the names are all confidential, kept very confidential like
and,
they are.
But
today.
You had an inkling that people were unhappy.
Well,
they
were. There were little kind of in the field at conferences and things like that. People would say they, you know, people don't believe it and things like that.
Like they thought you made up the data? What was that?
That would be the...
did that make you up? How did you feel when you heard that? Was that just infuriating?
Believe it. First of all, I didn't believe it because I didn't make it up.
Yeah.
So I just thought people couldn't believe the data. It would be like being told that you killed somebody on Christmas Day 2018, and you know you didn't do that because you were with your family and you have 6 or 7 witnesses, okay? So it's like, okay, yeah, sure. Somebody's accusing
you. So
you
kind of dismissed it because you
because
felt like...
Because we didn't do it.
Yeah.
First of all, we had all the data.
But it didn't bother you?
No.
Did it bother you?
Oh, no. People always say funny things sometimes in academia. Or look at that. I can't believe that whatever that product or there's a problem with the product. There's always... There's nobody... If there's 100% satisfaction anywhere, even when you vote or that. So no, it comes with the territory. I mean, even at your work, I'm sure somebody doesn't think that something you might do is the perfect thing. Not everybody agrees. So no, not at all. So now Mark and I get a recruitment to go to Vanderbilt. I'm in the midst of finishing my doctorate in psychology. Have about 6 months left to finish the dissertation, collected all the data.
And the dissertation was at?
It was at University of California, Irvine.
Okay.
And Dad gets an invite from Vanderbilt University to go there and be their clinical director of their alcohol program and on the psychology staff. And I got an opportunity to be on the adjunct staff at Vanderbilt, got there before my doctorate. And then I was also the director of the alcohol program at D.D. Wallace Mental Health Center.
Did they find you, the Vanderbilt people?
Well, they did a national recruiting, and somebody, one of the medical doctors, knew about Mark and gave them the name, and they contacted him. And he was young. I mean,
so it's kind of like headhunting?
Yeah.
Yeah.
We got there when we were 30 and 26. That is really young to go in being an associate professor and assistant professor. We get there, and we bought the house that you were born. In Nashville, Tennessee, and we begin our work. And I'm training graduate students over at D.D. Wallace Mental Health Center. I'm teaching a course at Vandy. Dad's doing the clinical training program, kind of like what we do now. Then we actually do hear that there's the couple of people out to that are accusing us of scientific fraud. And again, let me tell you something. I knew that at that time we had learned that Alcoholics Anonymous was really vehemently against everything we were doing, and I have never held any animosity. I well understood that what we were doing was threatening their very recovery base. And, you know, somebody recovered through AA, and that was, treatment was really non-existent in those days. Imagine, like, you take PTSD, imagine no treatment for that. So there, this was very controversial. It was working. Behavioral scientists were coming along at that time, so a lot more people were getting involved. And so they were upset, and I could understand that. But we had just heard that they were trying to get the list of names. It was like confidential.
Of the people that were in your study.
I'll give you the No. I'll give you the names of the two other professionals. Irv Maltzman, who actually died a couple of years ago. He was a well-known professor at UCLA and kind of had his area of research had kind of dried up. And then a lady named Mary Pendry, who was a what she called a recovering alcoholic, and she was his graduate student. This is now getting into a Dallas type television series that you cannot believe the connections in a few minutes. So
just a time check, you have 19 minutes, so you should have plenty of time. But
can we take can you stop it for a minute?
I think I can pause it. Yeah, hold on one sec. Here we go. All right, so we're back, and we were talking about Mary Pendry and a Dallas
and there's
saga.
Yeah, this is kind of like a television saga. You can't believe it. So Pendry begins to date Maltzman, who was her advisor. And so this whole thing is unbelievable. Then went out to the state hospital, was Maltzman's friend and research person.
No, and was he, his area of study was alcoholism?
No, not at all. It was pigeon stuff and operant stuff and all sorts of, had nothing to do with alcohol.
Okay.
The reason he got involved in it is because Mary Pendry had a serious alcohol problem, very serious. And she was his graduate student, then he started dating her and things like that. And then there were other characters involved that you can't even believe. They kind of told out at the state hospital there was a psychologist who said, oh, I believe they've lied and made it up. And he didn't like this other psychologist out there. So there's just a saga that when we write our book, it will go in. And I'm not even telling you the good part.
But you're skipping over a lot that I don't understand. So what did Irving Maltzman do or Pendry do?
He and Mary Pendry got the list of names.
But why were they interested? They're not even into alcohol research.
She was a recovering alcoholic.
And so she heard about your study and felt like it wasn't good.
And she was also the director of the detox center down in San Diego and said nothing could ever happen like that. Then she said she interviewed some patients that were at the state hospital, which was like 4 hours away. But she basically felt that she had interviewed people who said that we made it up, and she couldn't believe it could be done because she was a recovering alcoholic.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Irv Maltzman, a well-known scientist in another area, he was her advisor and was dating her, as I said. And so they kind of got together, and then they met up with some AA people who then, decided that they had to be investigated, that we had actually made all of it up because it couldn't happen. It would be like saying that the moon is square. And, we say it's square and people say, no, you're making it up. So they just didn't believe it was possible, and they set out to show that we had lied. That would be the only thing that made sense because we can't do it. And it's dangerous and we're killing people, okay? So that basically is going on. They eventually get a list of names to do this. They get stopped because this is where we met Glenn Caddy. They wanted to have not Mary Pendry and Irv Maltzman because they were very biased. The government felt they were biased about their attempts. They were saying get all the records. Then they said we didn't have records, but we.
But
actually,
what do you mean the government? You're skipping over some stuff.
There was a grant that we had. We had a small NIH grant to do follow up. So they went to that agency and said that the people made the research up and you need to investigate. The federal government did. And when you do fraud in science...
So you had a grant to do... You were currently doing follow-up?
Yes, 2-year follow-up.
Okay.
And anyway... No, it had actually been published by that time. But the point was, if you had a federal grant and you lied about it, they're going to disbar
you. So they accused you of lying, and they went to the government.
And they said they had data and they needed to interview all the subjects, and so they wanted to follow us up. So that they were trying to get the list of names. They eventually get the list of names... But at that point, the government says, look, what would really be best for you, this is Mark and I, for somebody to do an independent double-blind follow-up. That is, you find some...
Are we good? Sorry, I dropped... I think it's okay. So go ahead.
You get independent group of scientists that follow up, that have no agenda.
Uh-huh.
And that's where Glenn Caddy came in. He came over from Australia, had some experience in moderation work in Australia. He and a couple of other people did a what we call a third-year double-blind. They find out that the people are doing even finer, or that's no such word, but they're really doing okay, and they're not drunk, and they're not in graves, and they're not died, and so forth, because they said all these people, we were killing them.
Who said you were killing them?
Maltzman and Pendry and all the AA people that they were associating with. They went to
They were accusing you of killing the people.
Of, well, the, no, that the people were killed by our research.
Okay.
And
by having them do moderation instead of abstinence. Okay.
This thing went to Ronald Reagan. They were trying to shut us down through lots of things. Let me tell you, it's very complicated. Tried to get the list of names through Reagan because he was then governor of the state and we worked at the state hospital. If I don't fast forward, we're never going to finish it. So how much time?
14 minutes.
Okay. So anyway, Mary Pendry and Irv Maltzman were kind of set back for about 6 years until about 1980-ish.
And what were they set back from?
Because they were third-year independent double-blind.
Okay, so that was what
showing Glenn Caddy.
Glenn was doing.
Yeah,
okay.
Bob, yeah.
So that's how you met Glenn?
Yeah.
He was investigating you guys?
No, we knew him, but they needed somebody that knew how to measure this and do this, and he agreed to do it with as independent double-blind study.
Okay.
So we had another study supporting not only our earlier work, but that it got extended to a third year. And it showed that we didn't lie and that the control groups weren't doing as well as the experimental groups, and long story short. So that got published in the academic literature, and we were cleared. On we go.
This was in what year?
They published their stuff in, I think, 1979, 1980. But at that time, we were interviewing at the University of Toronto Addiction Research Foundation. They were trying to bring in people of our ilk, behavioral, moderation, doing all sorts of innovative, avant-garde stuff, and they recruited us from Vanderbilt. Dad actually, I believe, went up in 1979 to work because we had to stagger. I needed to finish my degree. We needed to sell the house, and so I moved a year later in 1980, and of course you were born by then in 1978. Mm-hmm. So we start our jobs at the University of Toronto Addiction Research Foundation, and that's when all hell broke loose. Basically, in February, I think it's February 4th, 1981, we get called into the president's office, who says, what do you know about a study that's being published in Science, the magazine, that says you've committed scientific fraud? And I was like, what? What do you mean?
What was that like?
Well, again, it was surreal. It was like, oh, what do you mean? I can't believe this. I know there's a lot of anger out there, but this is the first time we had heard about the independent, their supposed independent study.
This was Pendry and Maltzman.
Yeah.
They had done their own independent study?
Yeah. Not funded or anything. They never turned over one piece of paper or any evidence because they never did anything. They just made up their part of it. And they were trying to intimidate us to turn over stuff, which then they felt that nobody had, and we had made up all these records. And when you look at our records, they had been sitting for 20 years with paperclips on them in a basement. You know what happens to paperclips when they sit for a long time on things? They rust.
Mm.
They rust. And then we had stamped envelopes where people would send us information. So, you know, you had a 3-cent stamp, not the 20-cent stamp. You had the date on the letter.
Wait, but you're getting ahead of yourself. Can you tell me? So you went into his office and he just said, what is this? Do you know anything about the Science article where you're being accused of scientific fraud?
Yes.
And what did you say and what
said,
happened?
No, and the president said, well, there's an article that's going to Science, the magazine, that is accusing you of scientific fraud. It's going to be published in Science, the magazine. And what is this all about? And we had done the work, you know, 10 years earlier in the U.S. someplace else. So they both said, well, you better get the best lawyer money can buy because it sounds like a pretty serious thing, and we're going to have to suspend your privileges for a bit.
What does that mean?
Well, that you can do your work, but you can't see patients. That's
okay.
Clinical privilege. Because these are pretty serious charges.
Yeah.
So anyway, I mean, it's a long story, so 45 minutes doesn't give you enough things. So
you can always do more of it later. We can just pick up where you left off.
By this time, things are getting, go home.
Did you already know Danny and Loretta at this time?
Yes, we did.
You met them right when you moved to Toronto?
Met them within about 5 months of going to Toronto, so probably around September.
So did you tell them all about this? Did you know them all? Yeah.
Yes. Well, they go out with us one night when we find out about this. But anyway, so we were told this article is going to come out that's going to ruin our careers, going to embarrass the Addiction Research Foundation. And what it showed is that we made up all of our data. We never had anything. Patients were interviewed and said that they were never interviewed and that we lied about it. So at this point, the Addiction Research Foundation, I would say, is freaking out. They've hired these two fraudulent scientists, but they've got to defend them. And so they put together what was called a blue ribbon panel of four or five very premier, well-known, like a university professor, the leader of a university, a lawyer, really a politician that was well-known in the legislature. It was called the Dickens Committee, and Dickens was an eminent lawyer, and they put it together, and they basically gave them a total freedom to investigate. It's kind of like the Mueller investigation.
Yeah.
They were to come then up with a report within 6 months about whether or not what we had Pendery and Maltzman were alleging was true. They invited Maltzman and Pendery to come up and bring their data. Neither did Maltzman and Pendery ever turn over anything to the Dickens Committee, but they never turned anything over to NIH, National Institute of Health, to American Psychological Association, to any group they asked to investigate us or we were accused. Well, because they didn't do anything, first of all. We had arrest records, we had hospitalization records, more negative things on our subjects than they did. I mean, basically it was, I hate to use this word in this day and age, but a witch hunt. And if they could destroy us, they basically would have destroyed the concept in the field because it was so new. And here are these, you know, two young scientists that made it all up. So it was quite...
So the Dickens Committee did a six-month investigation. So what did that involve? What did that include?
Interviewing me about everything and anything, listening to... We had taped every subject. We had all their FBI records, all their hospital records. They interviewed every one of the staff that would work for us 12 years before, every single person, from the secretary down to the six research assistants to the technician on the unit, to verify that we were there doing it, that we had flipped coins to randomize people. So there were affidavits by all these people. I have a copy of the Dickens Committee I can give you if you would like.
So when it was happening, were you scared or?
When they were
even though you knew you yeah even no. though you knew you did well was it still you
I,
did it correctly
I
was it still scary?
I don't think we got scared until a little bit later. So because Dad and I were told to go home and get the best lawyers that money could buy, so we got a Canadian lawyer, a U.S. lawyer, because it happened in the U.S. We're talking about a big premier lawyer in the U.S. like they have now for the investigation.
Yeah,
I mean it was so costly, it was incredible. He had to borrow money from his uncle to pay. I mean, you know, you're talking about $250 an hour in those days. Like, oh my God,
wow,
where are the
like
facts?
Wow, it's like $1,000 an hour now or something.
We yeah. had three lawyers. I don't know $1,000, but a lot of money. Anyway, you know, we went home that night, and I was changing Kimberly on the change table, and Dad and I were talking about what they had said in the meeting with the president, and I said, you know, they're attacking our very basis for to be able to provide for the children because our careers would be over. And I can't let them do that. Do you realize what they're doing? And we'll end up in the Yukon, you know, shoveling snow or handing out ice cream rather than ever being able to work in our profession if we're found guilty. So that night we had taken everything with us from Nashville, all of our records from California to Nashville up to addiction to... Toronto, because every time we moved, we didn't have time to go through it. Typically, a scientist doesn't have to keep their records for more than about 7 years. Well, now we're into looking at them for about 20 years almost. Anyway, we started looking at all the records, and like it was like, you know, okay, let's have another shot. Look what I found. Listen to this tape. This is the accusation against us. This is this. So we were to provide basis for the accusations. If they said they never, people were never arrested, we had gotten, in those days you could get arrest records from the FBI and so forth, hospital records. We actually showed our subjects had more hospitalizations and arrests than these people. But it was, I think it was once the Dickens Committee was over, we kind of realized, wow, our career could have been over. And then it didn't stop. There was two APA investigations.
What happened with the Dickens Committee?
Oh, we were cleared, vindicated of all wrongdoing.
And was there media about that? Was that in a journal?
Oh, there was media all over. Newsweek, Time Magazine, 60 Minute.
Do you have all those?
Yeah, every single one.
5 minutes. Don't worry. We can just do another one, part two.
Because it won't ever finish.
So the Dickens Committee. When we get to the last minute, I'll sum up where we're at so we can know.
No, we have to. The Dickens Committee basically cleared us. They vindicated us of all wrongdoing, and said, you know, Science the process was followed. Science the magazine did not follow because they decided they would publish all of this stuff without publishing the control group data. They published a long article on Maltzman and Pendry's data, but they wouldn't give us more than 2,000 words, and that's not enough, so we had to go to another scientific outlet. But the reason is that the science editor at that time was a recovering alcoholic, as they say. So there was a lot of
connections. So he had a vested interest in AA as well.
So the Dickens Committee meets, and they basically made their findings very public to the Canadian populace, and of course there were reporters up from the U.S. and all over, because from the science perspective it was a big hot thing. If you could prove that clinical scientists had engaged in fraud, that was much better than what people were doing, and that is painting white rats black and saying that they had changed colors and things like that. But there was a lot of early on fraud in science, and this kind of got jumbled, mixed into it.
I'm confused. You talked about Dickens Committee.
Well.
And then what came next?
So the Dickens Committee comes out and said that we were vindicated on all accounts.
Great. And did the president feel like behind you then?
Yeah, and they just told us to get on with our work because we weren't hired to be investigated for that long. And so we get on with our work. And over time, somebody said, well, you know, you kind of went into a different area. We did a lot of different things like natural recovery and self-change and so forth, guided self-change, the clinical intervention, which is well known. And we published and published and published, and we felt it was better for others to replicate the moderation stuff than us.
Yeah.
And it is now a thing that the National Institute of Physicians can recommend as an alternative to abstinence for some individuals. And so forth. So the anger and all of that that's out there still exists in certain places like AA and that. But the scientific community, the medical community, actually look at looks at moderation as an alternative, a legitimate alternative. So there's a lot's changed. It could have changed faster.
Well, what happened with these other than there were two other investigations?
Well, that one was cleared too. Oh, no, there,
by the APA.
There were six investigations. Two American Psychological Association investigations, because they Pendry and Maltzman accused us there of lying and wanted to have us kicked out of the American Psychological Association. The National Institute of Alcoholism and Alcohol Abuse had one of the smaller grants. They wanted them to investigate us, but we'd already been cleared by NIH. There were a couple more. Anyway, all of them cleared us on every single count, every event. Someone colleague did an independent evaluation. I mean, there were people that just didn't believe us in the end. Other people did. We had a lot of cards and letters and support. Social networking didn't exist, but what we got was a phone call from somebody or support via letter that there was a very high board of science people that are the editors of Science Magazine, and so they all signed it saying that we were vindicated. So a lot of support. I'm going to recommend to you that you read the article called Moratorium on Maltzman.
I know, I've read that one in the past, just not long ago.
Okay, so that's
there's about a minute, so okay. How do you want to sum up, maybe talk about what you want to talk about next time, so we know.
I want to talk about the ending and how things came around and where they are now. But in between, there are some very funny stories about cross-country skiing and a $695 million lawsuit and some others that are funny. And we are going to write a book about it, but I'd like to sum it up and maybe then just talk about where our careers are now.
When are you going to write the book?
We're trying to clear our lives out so that maybe we can start it next year.
Cool. Yeah. That's a great idea.
Yeah.
Do you have an idea for the title?
Not yet.
Cool.
But anyway, we can just kind of sum up everything and where our careers are now.
Okay. Sounds good. So we'll take
and
off from
after. And
why
it was important to do it, because you would never have believed it, as you said.
Okay. All right. Signing off.